This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And this is Bernie Madoff talking about humanity's instinctive tendency to be greedy.
As honest as you try and get people to be, there's this normal, natural pull, you know, that you have to deal with.
He was speaking at a public roundtable in 2007, explaining how computers and algorithms had cleansed his business dealings of that regrettable impulse. You know, words can't describe a guy like that. Well, actually, two words can. Words that fit into a very long, very rich, and very American cultural tradition. OTM producer Jamie York is here to tell us what those two words are.
It's not monster, although that's the word New York Magazine used on last week's cover featuring him leering and made up like the Joker. Nor is it supervillain, although it used that word too. Now, the words that best fit the man who operated what may be the largest Ponzi scheme in history is confidence man. He's just the latest and greatest in a long line of American con men. So great, he even stunned the famously jaded news media.
All a lie. There were no trades, no stocks. All the money has disappeared.
No investments for 13 years. I mean, so essentially, if that is in fact true, all those statements he was sending out were just complete fabrication.
It's amazing. I have to say, when I first saw it today, I had to reread it a couple times so it could really sink in.
It now appears that even the world's best-known Holocaust survivor didn't touch the conscience of Bernard Madoff.
Con games are old as trickery and fraud, but the United States has provided fertile ground for the art to grow and thrive. Luc Sant is a writer, often about history, crime, and art.
The most famous original use of the term confidence in that way is in the title of The Confidence Man by Herman Melville. It proposes a certain kind of flimflam as being close to the heart of the national project.
The 1857 novel was the last work of prose Melville published in his lifetime. It's a story of steamship travelers heading down the Mississippi. It's also a profoundly cynical examination of what made our fledgling nation tick.
To a T, every single one of his victims are people whose eyes light up as they see the riches before them, or their perceived riches, the illusory riches, and gladly give the confidence man what he needs, which is confidence. Confidence that the confidence man will deliver.
Stephen Mim is a historian and author of A Nation of Counterfeiters, Capitalist Con Men and the Making of the United States. He says 1857 was the apex of a kind of financial chaos.
The national government had effectively ceded control of the money supply to private banks who got to issue paper money in quantities and designs effectively of their choosing. And by the time 1857 rolled around, you had almost 10,000 kinds of money in circulation, which, of course, was a crazy system. It was a system in which you really never knew what kind of currency someone was going to try to pay you with.
10,000 different kinds of currency meant that nearly any financial transaction was based almost exclusively on faith. Faith that was profoundly shaken any time folks wanted real money for their dubious paper. Banks often didn't have it. And when confidence in the banking system collapsed, so did commerce, as everyone tried to unload as much useless currency as they could onto each other. Mim says it was every man for himself.
Well, let's say that you're a counterfeiter, which was the quintessential confidence man of the era. You would go into a retailer and you would try to do everything in your power to convey the message that you were a good, respectable person. You would dress as nicely as you could, and you would fob off the bill onto them.
But here's the kicker. It's not simply the staging of a little fraud that makes for this gateway to the confidence game. It's the knowing complicity of the person being conned. That's what makes them a mark.
What's fascinating is that if you were running a store and someone came in and paid with a counterfeit note, you might know that it was a counterfeit note. But you would take it because it was a good counterfeit note, and you knew that you could pass it on to someone else. It didn't matter that it was counterfeit. It only mattered that it could pass.
Maybe that's when it started, when we first saw ourselves in the con man and the con man in ourselves. The con man was quintessentially American, geographically mobile when we were all learning to ride the rails, reinventing himself when this was the hope of every immigrant or city dweller, succeeding by using his brain, not his connections, which was the definition of the American dream. Americans had been seduced by these qualities from the moment the con man became a fixture in the penny papers of the 1800s. and ever since embodied over and over again on the silver screen. In the classic fictional con, we blame the victims because they're carefully selected. Bankers, business tycoons, millionaires, crime bosses. Ordinary guys can't win against the fat cats, but like James Cagney in the 1931 film Blonde Crazy, con men help to even the score.
Honey, I'm Santa Claus, Robin Hood, and the goose that laid the golden egg, all in one.
Pretty big package, aren't you?
But seriously, Anne, there's a lot of loose money lying around if you only know where to look for it. Now, the world owes me a living, and I'm going to collect it, see?
The con preys on anyone who believes that you can get something for nothing, and it takes two key forms. Luke Stant.
A short con takes place in the course of a single meeting, and it takes what the victim has in his or her pockets.
That's the hardy perennial, the three-card Monty game you think you're just about to win until you're broke. In contrast,
a long con or big con is a whole theatrical setup that takes place over a great span of time and always involves the victim going to get more money to invest in the scheme.
I got a partner downtown.
Robert Redford plays the long con on a mob boss in The Sting.
And he runs the central office of the Western Union. Now, race results from all over the country come in there and go right across his desk to the bookies. Now, all he does is hold him up for a couple of minutes till he can call us, get a bet down on the winner. Then he releases the results to the bookies. We clean up on a race that's already been run. Now, you can't miss, unless the Western Union dicks get a hold of it.
The Sting is explicitly based on a seminal book published in 1940, David Maurer's The Big Con, a scholarly work that reads like a novel. Maurer was a linguist fascinated by the mechanics and the patter of the con. He spent years recording the inner workings of a loose tribe of professionals. He found that the long con separated a mark from his money exclusively through a kind of cerebral jujitsu, one in which the mark gives over his money only because he wants to. There's no force, no intimidation. This could take weeks, months, or in Madoff's case, allegedly 13 years. Long con artists create phony stock offices, betting parlors, or banks, and hire dozens of other disguised con men to act as ropers. It's the brazenness of the con that pays off most, the iron fortitude required to risk detection and continue on. It demands a deep understanding of human behavior. It's theater for an audience of one. Luc Sant says that it's fitting that a linguist undertook this work because it's the language that has seduced writers for the last 60 years.
The language has this particular snap, crackle, and pop to it. The con is an area of American life that birthed an entire technical vocabulary, a very large one, as full of newly created nouns and verbs as sailing, for example, the shipping trades. They have a particular sound to them. Well, you can hear just in the names of the major cons, the wipe, the rag, the tat, the iron hat. They're short, but they're elemental, and they're as weighted as poetry.
Maurer's book set a template for the con movie. Dozens of them use his color commentary as a blueprint. The con man became shorthand for a slippery charmer who is, in fact, a dirty, rotten scoundrel.
Freddie, the women I deal with are carefully screened. They're wealthy and corrupt. I never take advantage of the poor or the virtuous.
All right. All right, we'll forget about the money, mm-hmm. But the bet is still on. We'll think up a whole new bet.
All right, what is the bet?
We'll make her the bet.
What do you mean?
What do you think I mean? First one to get her into bed.
When con men aren't preying on marks, they're inevitably going after each other. In films as different as Blonde Crazy and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, the confidence men are the last to realize that they themselves have been conned. We're led to believe that in the divine order, this is how crookedness regulates itself, that there's little honor amongst, as in this film, grifters.
Grifter's got an irresistible urge to beat a guy who's wise.
There's nothing to whipping a fool. Hell, fools are made to be whipped. But to take another pro, even your partner, who knows you and has his eye on you, that's a score.
But this is the movies, after all, so if there's any single force that can act as an antidote to the con, it's love. From The Music Man to Paper Moon to perhaps the best example, 1941's Preston Sturges film The Lady Eve, in which a mark played by Henry Fonda finds out that his lady, played by Barbara Stanwyck, is playing a con on him.
You see, Hopsy, you don't know very much about girls. The best ones aren't as good as you probably think they are, and the bad ones aren't as bad. Not nearly as bad. So I suppose you're right to worry, falling in love with an adventuress on the high seas.
Are you an adventuress?
Of course I am. All women are. They have to be.
The Lady Eve, in the end, is a very romantic movie about our illusions about one another, about the way we all deceive one another, especially in love relationships.
David Edelstein is the film critic for New York Magazine and NPR's Fresh Air.
We have this infinite faith that if people are indeed preying on us, that they all have the capacity to be transformed by love into opening up, into owning up, admitting their sins, confessing, and rebuilding our trust in them.
You weren't thinking of taking him, Harry.
Well, what were you thinking of?
I don't think you understand, either of you. This is on the up and up. I think I'm in love with the poor fish. I'm going to be exactly the way he thinks I am.
The Lady Eve uses love to strike a balance in the con game. Crime doesn't totally pay, and gullibility doesn't cost you everything. But there's another film version of what the con says about American life. David Mamet, a repeated purveyor of the con, has made a number of films that Edelstein says have the same basic message.
David Mamet lives by a certain credo, and that credo is there is always somebody out there who wants to screw you over.
You're not miffed at us, are you? I mean, nothing personal.
You guys were going to con me out of my money.
It was only business.
It was only business.
It was only business, huh?
It's the American way.
He sees all human relationships, especially relationships between male and female, as essentially cons. And David Mamet's role is to turn this into an existential test for his heroes. If they are to grow and to succeed, they must understand that they cannot trust anything around them. Unlike in The Lady Eve, where you really do feel as if there's some compromise possible between one's worst fears about human nature and one's greatest hopes about human nature.
The Lady Eve is a classic because its moral is one we want to be true, but it's hard to hold on to when Mamet's version of human nature seems to better reflect our real lives.
So you can't cheat an honest man?
That's probably true. But what we've just seen is the operation of a slightly different philosophic principle.
Which is?
Don't trust nobody.
His watch-your-back moral may have the most to teach us when the con is no longer an intimate negotiation, but rather a systemic abstraction like Madoff's computerized trading or the subprime mortgage crisis. Moore wrote in 1940 that
confidence games are cyclic phenomena. They appear, rise to a peak of effectiveness, then drop into obscurity, but they have yet to disappear altogether. Sooner or later, they are revived, refurbished to fit the times, and used to trim some sucker who has never heard of them. Until human nature changes perceptibly, there is little possibility that there will be a shortage of marks for con games.
A metaphor for Florida is that it's a Ponzi scheme. It was crazy.
New Yorker staff writer George Packer traveled to the epicenter of the country's housing crisis, where he found a Ponzi scheme writ large. In Florida, real estate had become the equivalent of the counterfeit bill from the 1850s that you took because you knew you could pass it. A rotten system that again made us complicit in our own undoing.
Ordinary people, secretaries, construction workers, were buying and selling multiple houses, speculating, flipping them. Real estate was everybody's source of wealth. I saw some records that showed houses being flipped for double overnight, literally. So it was unsustainable. It was a mirage.
This was greed putting all of us pigeons in a fever, suspending our better judgment, not just Madoff investors or mortgage signees, but all of us.
Economically, Florida does hold a kind of funhouse mirror to the country and shows us something true about ourselves. We live on debt. We don't think in the long term. We imagine that wealth can be created by simple transactions that don't actually require a whole lot of work. We don't want the government involved in our economic affairs. We don't want to pay taxes to support the services we expect. And those are all qualities that are on full display in Florida.
In all of the depictions of the con, from Jimmy Cagney to Paul Newman to Nicolas Cage, the drama hinges on a single moment, the reveal, when the con is exposed and the mark tries to make sense of what has gone wrong. Sometimes we're in on the finer points of the scheme, other times we're with the mark. It's a 90-minute lesson we pay to puzzle out in the safe space of the theater, where we can be our better selves. But Bernie Madoff and his flock of pigeons are, of course, terribly real. And they tell us something about ourselves we might not want to know.
I want you to promise me just one thing.
What, Lois?
When you grow up, don't you be the kind of woman who goes around deceiving men. Promise me that.
I promise, Mose.
That promise doesn't even hold until the end of the movie Paper Moon. And no amount of con depictions can prepare us for the real choices that confront us. In personal relationships, I do believe the Preston Sturges moral that love can defeat the natural impulse towards greed. But in the rest of life, where impenetrable financial systems hold sway and accountability is absent, I think Mamet's right. Love plays no role, and the con never really goes away. For On the Media, I'm Jamie York.
You talk about confidence. I'm a confident man from my boy. You talk about confidence. I'm a confident man from my boy. That's one thing, sure. Ooh, well, I've a confidence any woman lives on earth. I got a woman to take care of me. Yeah, she's just only 50-16. Yes, I got a woman to take care of me. Yeah, she's just on the sweet 16. I never done a deed work in my life. Ooh, well, I don't know even what work
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Catcher Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
There's no reason to be afraid of these people, but why in the world would you be afraid of the deranged?
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.